Mark chapter 8 this afternoon. I do want to express thank you for my family, to all who had a part in the food this afternoon and serving and all that. It was great. It was a hearty meal. That's what we call that. It was very good. Appreciate that. Mark chapter 8 this afternoon. I was looking up just before the service, a man named Elon Musk. Anybody heard of him? You know his name? I was looking up his net worth. And does anybody want to hazard a guess? A lot, yeah. More than a million. Are you ready for this? 480 billion. 480 billion. Incredible. I mean, it's beyond my comprehension. You know, we think like 100 is a lot, right? 1,000 maybe, you know, but 480 billion. How about the co-founder of Microsoft? Anybody who that is? Yeah, Bill Gates. That's who I was thinking of. His net worth is currently over 100 billion. Incredible. How about the founder of Amazon? Anybody know? Yeah, Jeff Bezos. Okay. He started Amazon in the 1980s, I think it was, in his garage. And pretty amazing what that has become today. But his net worth, I think, is in the mid 200 billions. Incredible amounts of money. You say, thank you for having us back to discourage us. Okay. With all these people with a lot of money. But it's incredible the amount of money that they have and what they can get with what they have. Now, just for a moment, I don't think that we have generally a great grasp of what a billion is. We understand million, but a billion is just like this astronomical number. So, that we can understand it a little better, a million seconds, you know, like one, two, those kind of seconds, a million seconds is about 11, 12 days. Okay, there's, I don't know, 86,000, 84,000 something seconds in a day. It's about 12 days. Does anybody want to guess how long a billion seconds is?
300 years.
Yeah, okay, we got a lot of good answers here. All over the world. No, it's good. 31 years. 31 years. That is just astronomically different than we typically think of. Here's another way to illustrate it. If you could stack pennies one on top of another, you know, stack them up in a tower, a million pennies would reach about to the top of the Empire State Building. Okay? A billion pennies would go to the moon and back to the moon again. It's a ridiculous amount. And so these men, as we think of it and talk about their, you know, how much money they have or whatever that's worth, they can have pretty much what they want. They have the money to buy it. They can buy, you know, the nice house with all the fancy cars. They can have the land. They can have the best seats at the game. They can have the team, right? I mean, they can get whatever they want. And in a sense, that can sometimes sound nice to us. You know, how many of us would not like more than we have, right? And so that sounds nice to us. But as we look at God's Word today, we're going to find out it's not all it's cracked up to be. In fact, we're going to read a story in a moment in the Old Testament of a king who had whatever he wanted, and yet it did not satisfy him like he thought it would. But let's go ahead and jump into Mark 8 here. We'll get to him in a moment. But Mark 8, go to verse 31. Mark chapter 8, verse 31. This afternoon, I'd like to look at three lessons from Jesus, three specific lessons that he teaches his disciples here in this passage. Notice verse 31 of Mark chapter 8. And he, Jesus, began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected of the elders and of the chief priests and scribes and be killed, and after 3 days rise again. And he spake that saying openly. And Peter took him and began to rebuke him. But when he had turned about and looked on his disciples, he rebuked Peter, saying, Get thee behind me, Satan, for thou savorest not the things that be of God, but the things that be of men. And when he had called the people unto him with his disciples also, he said unto them, Whosoever will come after me, So whoever wants to follow me, wants to be my disciple, and he gives some prerequisites here. Here they are. Let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. And then verse 35, he gives a sort of paradoxical statement. He says, for whosoever will save his life shall lose it. But whosoever shall lose his life for my sake in the Gospels, the same shall save it. For what shall it profit a man if he shall gain the whole world and lose his own soul? Or what shall a man give in exchange for his soul? Whosoever therefore shall be ashamed of me and of my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of him also shall the Son of Man be ashamed, when he cometh in the glory of his Father with the holy angels. The first lesson I'd like us to notice this afternoon is this. Suffering isn't always a bad thing. Suffering isn't always a bad thing. Notice verse 31 again. Jesus has gathered his disciples here. And what does he tell them? He says, it says he began to teach them that the Son of Man, who's the Son of Man? It's Jesus, must suffer many things, be rejected of the elders and of the chief priests and scribes, and be killed, and after 3 days rise again. This is the first time we have recorded in Scripture that Jesus told his disciples specifically what was going to happen to him. Now, I want you to place yourself in that situation. Here you are, following the one that you believe is the Messiah. You believe he's the one who is going to come. He's the promised one. You're following him, not just a good teacher, but the one who was promised from the Old Testament. You believe this is the guy. And you're following him. And yet now, he gathers his disciples and he says, I'm going to suffer. And I'm going to be rejected. And I'm going to be killed. Would that be perhaps scary for those disciples? Yeah. Now, we know the Old Testament talked about this, but we also know the disciples didn't always have the best picture of what was going to happen, a full understanding of it. And so I believe Peter here has a fairly understandable response. What does he do? It says, Peter took him and began to rebuke him. Now, that sounds harsh. We see from another gospel exactly what Peter said to the Lord. He said this, be it far from thee, Lord, this shall not be unto thee. In other words, what's Peter saying? Jesus has just explained, I'm going to suffer and be rejected and be killed. And Peter's saying, no, we're not going to let that happen to you. We're going to protect you. We're going to be with you. By the way, who was it in the garden that cut off the ear of the servant that was coming to take Jesus? It was Peter, okay? Peter, I believe, thought he was doing a good thing here. He says, no, we're not going to let these bad things happen to you. And yet what Peter didn't have a full grasp of was this. This was God's plan the whole time. God's plan was that Jesus would come and that he would suffer and that he would die. That he would be rejected. So Peter, he rebukes him. He says, you know, don't worry. Be it far from thee. This shall not be unto thee. But that was the reason Jesus came, to seek and to save that which was lost. Look at Jesus' response back to Peter in verse 33. But when he had turned about and looked on his disciples, he rebuked Peter, saying, and then notice what he says to Peter, get thee behind me, Satan. That's strong. Strong words there in a moment that I'm sure was very tense. Perhaps awkward, he tells him to get behind him. He calls him Satan. Now, why would he do that? Why would he say this to Peter? Well, in Peter's attempt, again, I believe, to do what was right, what was he actually doing? He was hindering. He was hindering what God's will was. He was getting in the way. And so Jesus tells him, get thee behind me, Satan. And he gives him a very specific reason at the end of verse 33. For thou savorest not the things that be of God, but the things that be of men. In other words, Peter's mindset was not on the eternal. It was not on God's, you know, redemptive plan into the future. It was what he could see. It was on the things of the earth. His mind was not where it needed to be. And again, I think Peter thought that he was doing a good thing, but he didn't understand that the suffering was part of the plan. And how often in your life and in my life do we not understand that the suffering isn't a bad thing? That the suffering is part of the plan. Something that God allows. You know, everything that takes place in your life, God either ordains it or He allows it. And if that's the case, you and I need to take the suffering that comes and recognize God wants to use it. God has a plan for it. Peter here, he wanted the suffering not to happen. But sometimes, you know, our trials, they don't have a free trial option where we say, cancel. I don't want that. Get rid of that one. We can't choose. They just come. But God desires to use it. You know, you think of Joseph's life and how he used all the difficulties. And Joseph had a rough life. I mean, he had a rough life. But God used everything in his life to bring himself glory and to help Joseph. And here he's telling his disciples that he is going to suffer. How often our focus is more like Peter's is. It's on the temporal. It's on the things that that we can see, that we can hold, the things that we can buy, the pleasures that we can enjoy, all of these things. And we miss God's eternal purposes at work, God's providential plan. May we purpose, and this isn't anything new, but may we purpose as suffering comes to us, that we wouldn't push it away and say, I wish this wouldn't happen, but that we'd use it for what God has brought it for, whatever purpose that may be. So lesson number one, suffering isn't always a bad thing. What's the second lesson we see here in this passage? Selfish pursuits bring emptiness. Selfish pursuits bring emptiness. Look again at verse 34. And when he had called the people unto him with his disciples also. So now it's not just his disciples. There's a crowd that has gathered as well. He said unto them, whosoever will come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. And then let's key in on verse 35 here. For whosoever will save his life shall lose it. But whosoever shall lose his life for my sake in the Gospels, the same shall save it. Did you know that you can save your life for yourself? Your money, your resources, your time, your relationships, whatever. You can fill in the blank with what you want to. But you can save it all for yourself, to bring yourself happiness, to further your goals, whatever they may be. But may I tell you, if you do that, you spend your entire life, every ounce of your being, trying to bring yourself happiness, you're going to lose your life. Maybe not literally you're going to die, although every one of us will at some point, but you'll waste it. It will not accomplish that which God desired to accomplish through you. God uses the servant who says, here am I, Lord. He doesn't use the one who says, what can I get out of this? What can I do? What do I want? He uses the one who says, God, what do you want? You can save your life for yourself, but you'll lose it. Notice what verse 36 says. For what shall it profit a man if he shall gain the whole world and lose his own soul? What profit is there? What gain is there? Now, certainly this would apply in regards to salvation. There's a person in life who gets everything that the world has to offer. They get the nice house, the nice cars, the good job, all of it, fill in the blank. They get all that, but they don't get Jesus in a relationship with Him. What profit is there for that person? What gain is there for that person? There's none. Fleeting moment of pleasure, perhaps, but then it's gone. And judgment comes. But I believe it also applies to the believer. What profit is there if you gain the world? You get everything the world has to offer. What benefit is that to you? There's none. What is valuable in this life? What pleases Him? Service to Him. That's what's valuable. Not the things that we can gather to ourselves. Keep your place here if you would, but turn over to Ecclesiastes chapter 2. It's right in the middle of the Old Testament. Psalms, Proverbs, Genesis, Ecclesiastes. Okay, you're still awake. That's good. That's good. Just checking. It is after Proverbs, though. Go to chapter 2, if you would. Ecclesiastes chapter 2. Whose life do we find in the book of Ecclesiastes? Solomon. A life that was, as we spoke of some of those men at the beginning, he had what he wanted. We'll see that in the passage we're going to read here. Ecclesiastes 2, we'll begin reading in verse 4. And notice all the things Solomon is essentially going through here and talking about all the things that he got, the things that he made, the things he had as king, as an incredibly rich man. And the book of Ecclesiastes is a book of a man, Solomon, searching for purpose in life, searching for satisfaction in life. And it's an incredible book. You ought to read it if you get a chance soon, because Solomon goes through chapter by chapter and he seeks to find purpose in different areas, whether it's in man's work or whether it's in pleasure or things or wisdom or whatever it is. He searches for it in all these different things. In chapter 2, he's searching for that in the things that he has gotten. Notice verse 4. He says, I made me great works. I builded me houses. I planted me vineyards. I made me gardens and orchards. And I planted trees in them of all kind of fruits. I made me pools of water, to water therewith the wood that bringeth forth trees. I got me servants and maidens, and had servants born in my house. Also I had great possessions of great and small cattle, above all that were in Jerusalem before me. I gathered me also silver and gold, and the peculiar treasure of kings and of the provinces. I got me men singers and women singers, and the delights of the sons of men, as musical instruments, and that of all sorts. Notice verse 9. So I was great, and increased more than all that were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me, and whatsoever mine eyes desired, I kept not from them. I withheld not my heart from any joy, for my heart rejoiced in all my labor. And this was the portion of all my labor. Verse 11. Then I looked on all the works that my hands had wrought, and on the labor that I had labored to do, and behold, all was vanity and vexation of spirit. And there was no profit under the sun. Hey, Solomon had it all. You take it into our modern context, and he had the mansion on the Gulf Coast with the, you know, the four-car garage and the Ferraris. I mean, he had the position and he had the money to get whatever he wanted. Did you notice there in verse 10? Whatsoever mine eyes desired, I kept not from them. Now, that could sound nice to us, right? If I just saw something I wanted, I could have it. That would be awesome, all right? I was asking a group of kids one time, what is one thing that you could have that would make you happy? You know, if I just had this one thing, then I'd be happy. How many of us have ever thought that before, right? If I just had this, then I'd be happy. And I asked a group of kids this one time. First kid raised his hand and called on me. He says, salvation. And I thought, you're going to ruin my illustration. Good answer, though. He had the good answer. Some of the other kids gave more what I expected. You know, I want a battleship or a cat. Why? I don't know. But a cat. I think one kid said a dog, and all these different things. When I was a kid, I really wanted a basketball goal, a nice one. You know, I'd be sitting in the car riding along, and I'd look out. We'd be driving through a neighborhood, and we'd see the nice basketball goal with the big, you know, glass or plexiglass backboard, nice orange breakaway rim, and all this. And I thought, man, if I just had that, you know, a nice pad of concrete with the lines in my backyard. But if I had that, I would be happy, right? And I never got it. And so I had to find a new dream. And so I got a little older, and I really wanted a air rifle, like a BB gun type thing. And I found one. Yeah, amen. And I found one. I don't remember. I think it was at Walmart, actually, that I saw it. And I saved up money, and I bought it. And I had fun with it. It was great. And then one day I was in my room and I was looking for something. I don't remember what. And this was one of my messy stages. Okay. And so I was in my closet trying to sift through stuff, trying to find whatever I was looking for. And guess what I found in the back of my closet? The air rifle. I thought, wow, I forgot about this. This is so much fun. And I realized, you know what this rifle didn't do for me? It didn't make me happy. It might have for, you know, a moment, a couple weeks or whatever, but it did not satisfy me. And did you know that we can live our lives that way? In fact, there are so many people, believers and non-believers alike in our world today, that is their life. The next best thing, the bigger house, the nicer car, the newest iPhone. There's a reason people are camped out at Best Buy, you know, the night before they can get the newer iPhone or whatever it is on Black Friday or whatever. What are they? They've got to get the next best one, right? The new one comes out and they're like, this old piece of trash. I need the one with 13 cameras on it, right? I've got to get the new one. And we can do that in small things, but you can do that in big things too. On a very small scale, how many of you have ever, you don't have to raise your hand, but you've spent 2 hours scrolling on your phone at night. What are you doing? Well, you're wanting the next thing, and none of it ever really satisfies, does it? It doesn't. There's only one thing that satisfies, and that is God. Solomon, again, the book of Ecclesiastes. This is a guy who had everything. And I'm glad we have somebody like this in Scripture, because otherwise I think, yeah, but if I just, I know that this thing didn't satisfy, but if I just got the next bigger thing or the better thing, then it finally would satisfy. Hey, Solomon had everything. He had whatever he wanted. And he says, what did he say in verse 11? It's all vanity and vexation of spirit. In other words, it's empty. It's worthless. It doesn't satisfy me. It doesn't bring me peace. In fact, it troubles me. There was no joy in it. There's no satisfaction in it. We could search all our life for these things. Solomon, he writes, you can't find satisfaction or purpose in this. It's not in this. It's not in this. You get to the very end of the book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 12. What's he say? He says, let's hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep His commandments. That's where purpose is found. That's where joy is found. So when you are tempted by what our world has to offer, and we are all the time, we're constantly being pumped stuff. You ought to want this. You ought to desire this. And we can fall into that so easily. When that is the temptation for you, recognize and remember this. Fearing God and keeping His commandments, that's where joy and purpose is found. It's not found in all these things that I can get for myself. So lesson two, selfish pursuits will bring emptiness. But thirdly, our last lesson from Jesus in Mark 8, and you can turn back there if you would, back to Mark 8. The third lesson is this, submission to God brings life. Submission to God brings life. Selfish pursuits, they're going to bring emptiness. But submission to God brings life. Look back at verse 34 of Mark chapter 8. And when he called the people unto him, with his disciples also, he said unto them, whosoever will come after me, and he lists the three things, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. So Jesus, again, he's not just speaking to his disciples now, he's talking to a larger group of people. He says, hey, if you want to be my disciple, if you want to be a follower, you got to do these things. The first one that he lists there is, let him deny himself. Now, if you've noticed anything, you probably noticed this, we don't like to deny ourselves things. You know, if there's one cookie left on the plate in the kitchen, you walk past and think, well, I shouldn't have any because I've already had 12. And so you keep walking. And then you got to walk through the kitchen to get to something again. And you look back, and you look at it a little longer this time. No, I really don't need to do it. And then, conveniently, it's time to scrub down the cabinets in the kitchen. You haven't done this in 5 years, but it seemed like a really good time. And so you go in, and oh, wow. And pretty soon you've eaten the cookie, right? We don't like to deny ourselves things that we want. One of the things that we least like to deny ourselves is comfort. We don't like to deny ourselves comfort. There's so many inventions in our world today that are solely for the purpose of comfort. Right? You get the heated steering wheels and the heated seats, and you have all the automatic this and that just to make your life, you know, that much easier. You need to go to Walmart or the store and people are walking around in their pajamas. Why? They want to be comfortable, right? I mean, that's why they're doing it, right? And don't do that, by the way. Please don't do that. And people want comfort. That's what they desire. We don't like to deny ourselves that. You say, well, is it bad to be comfortable? No, it's not wrong to be comfortable unless that becomes what you seek after. That becomes your goal, what you want more than anything else. It becomes a higher priority than other things. What happens when comfort begins to be what I seek? What's the problem with that? Well, if I seek comfort above anything else, I'm not going to want to tell people about Jesus. Why? Because it's uncomfortable. It's hard. If I seek comfort above anything else, I'm not going to want to go to church 3 times a week. Why? It's uncomfortable. It's inconvenient. Right? If I seek comfort above anything else, I'm not going to want to deal with my own sin. Why? It's uncomfortable. It's difficult. If we want to be a disciple, a committed follower of Christ, we must deny ourselves. Now, while all that is true, the idea in this verse of deny himself, let him deny himself, isn't self-denial like I just described it. Now, that's a biblical principle, but that's not what this verse is talking about primarily. What's this verse talking about when it says to deny yourself? Essentially, it's this: denying yourself the right to be in charge. I think even of as when Peter denied the Lord 3 times, people came to him, you know, do you know this guy? Are you associated with me? You know, no, I don't know this guy. He has no control over me. I don't know this guy, right? What's he saying? He's denying him. And we are to deny ourselves. Who ought to be the ones in control in our lives? It ought to be the Lord. He ought to be the one directing our life, not us. In other words, we are not the boss of our own lives. We're not. He is the one that we look to. 1 Corinthians says it very clearly. It tells us we are not our own. We are bought with a price. Therefore, glorify God in your body and in your spirit, which are God's. This isn't my body. God has given me stewardship over it to do what He wants me to do with it. But it's not mine. I don't have any right over it. He does. My body, my life, none of it's mine. It's His. God has given us time on this earth. He's given us physical abilities. Why? To steward for His glory. To do what He desires. To accomplish His will. We are to deny ourselves. I don't have the right to do whatever I want to do. I have the right to do what He's told me to do and what He desires. Galatians 2:20 says this: I am crucified with Christ. Nevertheless, I live. Yet not I, but Christ liveth in me. We must deny ourselves and let Christ live through us. What's the second thing he lists there in verse 34? Not only let him deny himself, but also take up his cross. Now, perhaps some of you have heard this before. Somebody might say, well, we all have our crosses to bear. Maybe you've heard that before. And what they mean by that is, you know, we've all got hardships. We've all got difficulties in life that we got to deal with. But I want you just for a moment to think through the lens of the disciples. You know, as we look back on the cross today, we sing songs like the old rugged cross, you know, lead me to Calvary. And we look back and think about the cross as a story of God's great redemptive plan of love towards us. And we ought to, okay? That's good. But Jesus hadn't died on the cross yet. What was going through the minds of the disciples and those who were gathered when Jesus said, take up your cross? What was the cross to them? Yeah, in that day, it was an instrument of death, a humiliating death, one in which the person who was going to be crucified would often have to carry their cross in an act of submission to the Roman government. That's what the cross meant to them. So when Jesus says to these people here to follow him, they have to take up their cross. This really goes right along with the idea of denying ourselves. We are in submission to who? Not the Roman government, to Him, to the Lord. If you're going to be a committed follower of me, you've got to deny yourself and you've got to take up your cross. You've got to be submitted to me. It goes right along with that denying ourselves. As Paul said elsewhere, I die daily. Dying to self. We must submit and humble ourselves and die to self by carrying our cross in submission to Him. Our life really is not our own. You know, it'd be a good thing for us to consider and to say is this: what I want doesn't matter. What He wants does. Would that change a lot about our lives? Yeah. We quickly realize how selfish we are. You know, when I became a parent, I realized very quickly how selfish I am. Because what I want doesn't always work, right? I might have to do something I don't want to do. Not that you don't have to in other areas of life, but parenting was like, whoa, okay. I have to do what I'm supposed to do, not necessarily what I feel like doing right now. In our lives, our responsibility is to obey Him. Romans chapter 12, our bodies are a living sacrifice. What's the problem? I heard one man say this. Living sacrifices tend to crawl off the altar. Say, Lord, I'm yours, but then I'm going to go do this. No. God, whatever you want. What's a sacrifice? Well, it's something that's offered. Its life is taken completely and it's killed. What's a living sacrifice? Well, it's something that's taken. Its life is taken, but it's not killed. Our life is His, not ours. And we ought to be submitted to Him, whatever that means. So I want to just challenge you this afternoon. If you want to be a committed follower, Jesus said, hey, if you want to come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. So I'll leave you with this afternoon. Are you submitted to him in humility? Are you saying what Jesus said, God, not my will, but yours be done? Father, would you...